Hello and welcome to this special UKCP podcast. I'm Jenna Rashid, the Digital Engagement Officer at UKCP. In this episode, we speak to Martha Williams, the Senior Clinical Advice Coordinator for the UK's leading eating disorder charity, BEAT. In her role, Martha works with the media on eating disorder representation and on various projects, including peer support training. Our host, Gladys Ellis, is a UKCP systemic family psychotherapist specialising in eating disorders with under 18s. With extensive experience working in the NHS and specialist eating disorder services, Gladys is also a supervisor, trainer and consultant. Stay tuned to hear Gladys talk to Martha about perceptions of eating disorders and the role NHS mental health services and psychotherapy play in supporting a person who is experiencing disordered eating.
Welcome, Martha. It's lovely to have you on board.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Lovely. So, Martha, what does your role as BEAT Senior Clinical Advisor Coordinate involve?
Yeah, it's a really varied role, but it essentially includes ensuring that all of BEAT's services, our trainings, our campaigns and communications are all founded on good quality evidence and are guided by service user experience and also clinical expertise. And we also do a lot of work with the media, so ensuring that eating disorders are accurately portrayed. And I've also been working on a project in collaboration with the NHS in the Southwest to develop and deliver eating disorder specific training for peer support workers.
Wonderful. I know BEAT's work over the years. It's such an important organization in eating disorders. Tell me, how impactful is media representation of eating disorders? And how has that changed over the years?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think media representation of eating disorders can have a really significant impact on public perceptions and kind of individual attitudes and the way that eating disorders are understood and approached. And I think sometimes with the media, they can often portray eating disorders in quite a stereotypical manner. So that might be focusing solely on kind of very extreme cases or glamorizing disordered eating behaviors. And I think the issue with this is that it can create misconceptions about who is affected by these eating disorders and what they truly entail. And I think this is why we really try to work with the media to try and reduce this and ensure that they actually report responsibly on eating disorders, because the issue is if the media perpetuates stereotypes about eating disorders, it can be really harmful because it can lead to those who exist outside of that stereotype not really realizing that they have an eating disorder, because they, you know, they see people in the media and they think, oh, I don't look like that person, therefore I can't have an eating disorder. And what this does is this puts them at serious risk, because the sooner an eating disorder is recognised, the sooner someone can access support, and then the better their chances are at making a full and sustained recovery. So that's why accurate media representation is so, so important. And we feel really strongly about that. But I think what is good is that we have noticed that over the years, media representation is becoming a lot more varied and more diverse. And I think if we look recently at the EastEnders storyline, they had a male character called Ben Mitchell who developed bulimia. And that was really positive, because actually eating disorders don't just affect kind of white, female, young women. They can affect anyone. So we were really pleased to see kind of some diversity and representation in the media in terms of eating disorders. For Eating Disorders Awareness Week last year, we focused on those who identify as male and eating disorders. So we did a whole campaign around kind of eating disorders in men, which I think was really, really important. And I think that definitely helped certain people to come forward and actually say that they were suffering with an eating disorder that maybe wouldn't have had the confidence or wouldn't have been able to come forward before. So that's really, really important. And we did make it a big focus of our campaigns last year, which was really good to see.
Sounds really wonderful. I guess you've touched a little bit on social media. I work with under 18s, and we know over the years, and in particular during the pandemic, when young people turned to social media as a way of keeping connected with peers or with what was happening, we also know that young people were really vulnerable to influencers. We're really vulnerable to things that they were watching on certain platforms that can be quite innocuous. But actually, when kids did present, they talked a lot about how social media had impacted either when they were, you know, having ideas or they were feeling vulnerable. Has BIT ever been invited to have a role in evaluating or moderating content? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And we have definitely been involved in conversations before with some of kind of the larger social media platforms on how they can kind of put, I guess, controls in place to make sure that people are using social media safely. So we have definitely been part of conversations in the past, but I think there's still a lot more work to do because I think social media can be really positive because it's a way for people to connect with other people who are going through similar things. But I think, like you've touched on, there's also a very dark side to it, and there are so many kind of social media trends that we've seen that really negatively impact people with an eating disorder that might seem quite innocent on the surface. But actually, if you're someone that's suffering with an eating disorder, they can be really harmful. And I think an example of that is these kind of what I eat in a day videos. I'm not sure if you've come across those. Yeah, which, you know, to someone kind of just scrolling through their newsfeed that isn't suffering with an eating disorder or isn't vulnerable to developing one, that might be fine. But if you've got someone that's really struggling, and you've got someone showing what they eat in a day, there's going to be this kind of temptation to copy what that person's eating because you might think, oh, I want to look like that person, therefore I'm going to eat the same. When actually that's so dangerous because we all have totally different, you know, needs in terms of kind of how much food we need and all of that kind of thing. So I think those are one of the ways that it can be really dangerous.
This is such a hot point. Thank you so much, Martha. And you know, the way that sometimes people post things, if people are having a really like vulnerable and hard day, that can be quite impactful and unhelpful, right?
Yeah, and I think what's scary as well is social media is becoming so much more accessible. Like I see so many more young people using it. It seems like the age that people are starting to use social media is getting kind of younger and younger. And, you know, when you're really young, you're vulnerable, you're impressionable, and it's really, you know, scary to think the types of accounts that you follow, you have no way of knowing if the person that you're following is in recovery or not.
From your point of view, Martha, how important is the right support for someone living with an eating disorder?
I think it's really important. And I think what's most important to raise here is that an eating disorder looks different on everyone. So there's no kind of one way that an eating disorder presents. So I think when it comes to treatment, there needs to be quite a holistic view of the individual, taking into account how the eating disorder presents for them. And then there needs to be quite an individualized care plan. And I think, you know, that's one thing that people need to understand is that eating disorders, yeah, just don't look the same on everyone. So therefore, each individual's treatment is going to look slightly different. And I think we need to be aware of that and be aware of the different ways that an eating disorder can manifest.
Absolutely. That's so great because, of course, you know, I remember when we did the access and waiting times in under 18s and, well, it's not so recent, the DSM-5 diagnostic manual, you know, it doesn't really name a weight that young people need to be for them as long as they have got the distressing cognitions and the anxieties. Yeah. And, you know, weight is not a prerequisite for people to get support. So,
yeah,
you know, this is really important. You know, there's differences, isn't it, between under 18s who are still at home with their carers and parents, you know, the young people who transition to university, people who might be in my age group over 50s who are living with an eating disorder, you know. Is there something you want to say about that?
Yeah, again, I think it's about looking at the individual as a whole and looking at their lifestyle and looking at how long the eating disorder has been around, looking at why they might have developed the eating disorder. Like you say, you know, someone who's kind of under 18 or someone in their 50s, they're going to have very different lifestyles, very different situations. So I think there needs to be a thorough assessment of that individual, and different things are going to be helpful for different people. But it's likely to be a combination of a few different things. And I think with eating disorders, it's really important that, yes, you need that psychological support, but actually eating disorders carry huge kind of physical risks as well. So you need a really solid medical team. You need someone that's going to be looking at kind of nutrition and dietetics. You might need kind of occupational therapy. It really is kind of a multidisciplinary approach, I think, when it comes to eating disorders. And it's crucial that someone has kind of all of those components involved in their care.
Great, Martha. I'm going to ask about multidisciplinary teams later. And I guess the other thing to add to that, isn't it, is that young people under 18, we know that working with their family has the best evidence. NICE says it, and we know from clinical experience that young people who are still at home, they really kind of need that support from parents.
Definitely.
And it might be different from someone who's at uni or, you know, living independently.
Yeah, I think family-based treatment, like you say, for that age group is so, so important, because we always say that eating disorders are kind of a family illness. Yes, they impact the person that's experiencing the eating disorder, but actually they really impact the family too. So it's really important to consider kind of siblings and parents and carers and everyone that's involved, and make sure that everyone has access to the right information and to support as well.
That's great. Thanks, Martha. And what does recovery look like?
That's such a good question. And I think we always get asked this, and I always say that I think recovery from an eating disorder is so different for each person. So some people might find that they never have an eating disorder thought again. Others might have eating disorder thoughts, but may have found ways of kind of coping with them or ways to avoid acting on them. I think some people we experience, they describe themselves as fully recovered, and others might say that they're in recovery. And I think there's no right or wrong answer. It's whatever feels most authentic for that individual person. So I think, recovery is a huge term that really looks different for a lot of people. But I think at Beat, we really strongly believe that recovery is possible. And every day we speak to people who are kind of living full and happy lives away from their eating disorder. But I think if you wanted like a picture of what recovery could look like, I guess you might expect to see some kind of improvements in physical health. So there might be restoration of weight, improved energy levels, improved overall health. There may also be some behavioral changes. So someone might have kind of positive changes in their eating habits, like establishing a regular eating pattern or reducing harmful behaviors like restriction or purging. And also sometimes we see kind of cognitive shifts. So there might be changes to their thought patterns and beliefs about food, weight, body image, and also lifestyle changes. They might start kind of re-engaging in activities that they used to enjoy. So really different for each person, but will probably involve some of those components.
That is such a thorough answer, Martha. Thank you so much. I guess the other thing that I would also want to add, I know I'm talking to you, but for young people, you know, who are still developing, in particular young women, I think having periods is really important. So, you know, if young people have had absence of periods, we know that 6 months, you know, the precursor to, you know, bone disease can start.
Yeah.
And so for young people who are still building their bone mass, their bones that they're going to have for tomorrow, we know that there's no recovery without weight restoration, you know.
So right. Really important. We see, you know, a lot of people that have had absence of periods for a long period of time, and then it means that they're, like you said, they're increased risk of kind of osteoporosis or osteopenia. So restoring that function is really, really important in recovery.
What eating disorder support does Beat offer? And this is a really wide question.
Yeah, I'll try not to kind of go on for too long, but because we do offer lots of different things, but I think probably one of the things that we're most well known for is our helpline. So we're available 365 days a year to help those with eating disorders, as well as people caring for a loved one with an eating disorder. So our helpline is open from 1 p.m. till 9 p.m. on weekdays, and from 5 p.m. till 9 p.m. on weekends and bank holidays. And we offer confidential support, information and guidance for anyone affected by an eating disorder. We also run online support groups. So we offer moderated online support groups and forums. And this is where individuals can come and connect with others who are going through similar experiences. And we also run support groups for carers. So a good example of that is our Coping with Celebrations course, which is a free Zoom session that helps carers guide their loved ones towards recovery during the festive season. So that's always really popular around Christmas time. And we also offer training sessions and workshops for healthcare professionals. And these sessions aim to raise awareness and enhance understanding of eating disorders and improve support strategies. So those are kind of some of the things we do, but we also do a lot of kind of campaigning and policy work and support with the media and lots of different things.
A lot of families that I've worked with, they have dipped into BEAT support services in a really helpful and powerful way. So are you saying that you don't have any more face-to-face, everything has gone online now?
Yeah, everything now is done online. We've just found that that makes it a lot more accessible for people, and it means that we've been able to kind of widen our reach, and it's
Right.
just a lot more convenient for people to kind of be able to log on to Zoom.
Great. Thank you so much, Martha. Now, I know you're training to become a UKCP psychotherapist.
Yeah.
How is this informing your work with BEAT?
Yeah, I've loved my training to become a psychotherapist, and I think it's definitely been really useful for my work at BEAT. And I think particularly when there have been times where I've worked on some of our programs supporting those affected by an eating disorder, and it's kind of really helped me with that ability to actively listen and show empathy and really help me to understand their experiences and foster that kind of strong therapeutic relationship, which has been really beneficial to then the work that we've gone on to do. And I think as well, having a strong understanding of psychological theories, different therapeutic modalities, and evidence-based practice has also been helpful in order to help me inform the work that we do at BEAT, such as our training packages, support programs, and campaigns. I think also, as I'm sure you'll know, that training to become a psychotherapist has kind of really, really pushes you to be very self-aware and constantly reflective. And I think that's helped as well with lots of different aspects of my work. And I think one of the main things is like being very culturally aware and kind of culturally competent, because at BEAT, we're constantly striving to reach more diverse audiences and ensure that as many people receive our support when they need it, regardless of their background. So that's really, really helpful. And also, I think just dealing with people's distressing emotions can be challenging. And as a therapist, you need kind of resilience and emotional stability to be able to manage our own emotional response and still be able to provide support. So that's been really helpful to keep me resilient at work, particularly when you're dealing with quite a distressing situation or supporting someone that's in a really bad place. It's kind of useful to be able to continue to provide support.
Thank you, Martha. I was also curious to sort of think with you about psychotherapy and eating disorders kind of in general. And what are your thoughts, you know, about what should therapists know about eating disorders?
Yeah, that's like such a good question. I think the first thing I always really want to say to people, because I think one of the main misconceptions is that eating disorders aren't actually really about food. So eating disorders are a symptom of deep emotional distress. And therefore, I think it's really important that a therapist should be aware of kind of the psychological and emotional underpinnings of an eating disorder. So that might be body image issues, it might be perfectionism, low self-esteem, trauma, anxiety, or depression. Obviously, there is a part that's related to food and eating behaviours, but I think in order to treat the eating disorder, you need to really address the psychological and emotional components rather than just focusing on the behaviours or looking at what they are or aren't doing with food. So I think that's probably one of my number ones. And I think we've mentioned it a bit before as well, but I think it's really important to mention cultural sensitivity. So being able to recognise cultural influences on body image and eating disorders is so important, because eating disorders can manifest differently across various cultures due to those kind of differing societal norms and different cultural values and perceptions of image and beauty. And I think it's really useful to be able to recognise how cultural factors may influence the development and expression of an eating disorder in diverse populations, because it's not going to look the same. And I think as a therapist, you really need to be aware of that. Also, it's important to know the possible risks and medical complications so that you're able to signpost to medical or nutritional support when needed, because we touched on it earlier, but eating disorders do carry kind of significant physical health complications as well. So I think the therapist needs to be aware of those just in case there does need to be a referral to a medical team or something like that. And I think as well, just knowing the different diagnostic criteria and types of eating disorders can be really helpful, because that can help with the kind of accurate assessment and treatment planning, and to understand what someone may be presenting with. So knowing the differences between kind of anorexia nervosa or bulimia nervosa.
This is just so important, because I suppose you've touched on it, that, you know, eating disorders can be life-threatening. You know, this is a really serious illness, which it's up there with psychosis in terms of when things really are very, very difficult, that people can lose their liberties. I'm talking about extreme situations.
Yeah.
And people can end up being treated under the section of the Mental Health Act, you know. Mm-hmm. So what you said is so important about needing to know the differences. You know, what does AFID look like? Because AFID can also be diagnosed in adults. How does it differ to anorexia restrictive? How does it differ to anorexia binge purge? How does bulimia present? You know, it's so important that therapists, as much as people sometimes can have a concern about the medical model, I think this is one of the conditions that, in a sense, we need to educate ourselves, access the diagnostic manuals to be able to look and to know at what thresholds, as you say, do you need to refer on from. In particular, I guess I was thinking about people in private practice. How would you support a client you're working with to access the appropriate multidisciplinary team?
I was going to say, I think you've raised something really important there as well, which I didn't mention, which is being aware of all eating disorders, because like ARFID, you know, when people think of eating disorders, they might think of anorexia, bulimia and binge eating disorder, but actually there are so many other lesser known eating disorders, like you've mentioned, like ARFID or PICA, and it's really important that we're aware of all the different types of eating disorders rather than just kind of the main ones that seem to be the most common.
And I guess within that, as therapists, also know what the guidance is out there. You know, we all have access to NICE. I think these are guidelines that are so important to be able to equip ourselves as psychotherapists, not just people in private practice, but even people who are working in generic MDTs, to be aware of that so that one knows when you need to escalate things, when you need to support the person you're seeing to get, you know, more help. In young people, we have the MASEPIN, which is the management of seriously ill children. You can access that on the websites.
Yeah, and there's the new guidance, MEED, which is the Managing Emergencies and Eating Disorders, which again is that really, really important, that document.
Absolutely. And I think, despite the fact that it's all, you know, within the medical model, I think we have a duty of care and a responsibility, if we are going to be supporting people with eating disorders, that we know all of these pieces of guidance, so, you know, we are safe practitioners.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, like with anything, continuous education and making sure that you're staying updated with the latest research and advancements in the field are essential as well, like you've said, for therapists working with individuals with eating disorders, because I think we all have a responsibility to provide kind of comprehensive care.
Mm-hmm. On that note, how much does BEAT provide training as an organisation?
Yeah, we do a lot of training for healthcare professionals. So we have some really great online packages for kind of GPs, dentists, dietitians, junior doctors, in order to kind of help them be able to spot the early warning signs of an eating disorder. Because we've run a campaign before and we found that when people are going through medical training, they only receive something ridiculous like 2 hours of training on eating disorders, which is just nowhere near enough. Yeah. So we've created this training package to help fill that gap.
It sounds wonderful, Martha. Thank you.
No, thank you.
My last question.
Yes.
We've talked already about some of this, but maybe you could just thrash it out a bit more. How important are multidisciplinary teams to those experiencing an eating disorder?
Yeah, really good question. And I think because eating disorders are so complex, an MDT approach is really needed in order to bring together professionals from various different backgrounds. So we've touched on it before, but kind of psychiatrists, psychologists, dietitians, occupational therapists. And I think that this ensures that someone with an eating disorder receives evidence-based and comprehensive care. And I think an MDT approach is also important because it really ensures a holistic understanding of the individual's needs, and it can really help to address kind of the multiple different dimensions of the eating disorder and increase the chances of a successful recovery. And I think one thing as well about an MDT approach is it really allows for better coordination between professionals, which then hopefully leads to kind of more effective and personalized care for that individual. So again, it's that kind of holistic approach and addressing all of the different needs of the individual rather than just focusing on kind of one component of the eating disorder, because we know that eating disorders are kind of made up of lots of different components. So it's really important to have that kind of varied and MDT approach.
Thank you so much, Martha. I really appreciate your emphasis on that. You're absolutely right about the importance of multidisciplinary teams, because I think not having access to one, I guess I'm thinking also about people who are practicing alone in private practice. If you're going to give a safe and good service to this client group, that it's so important that there's an MDT that people can have access to. You know,
Yeah,
it's so
absolutely.
important to help this population be safe and be on their way to recovery and the right support that they need. Oh, thank you so much, Martha. This was such a powerful conversation. And I just really want to thank you for giving your afternoon for us to have this discussion.
Oh no, thank you very much for having me. It's been great. I've really enjoyed it, and yeah, thank you.
Wonderful.
That was Martha Williams speaking to UKCP psychotherapist and eating disorder expert Gladys Ellis. Find information and support on eating disorders on BEAT's website, www.beateatingdisorders.org.uk. If you're interested in exploring training, then you can visit our psychotherapy training page, where you can find information on psychotherapy as a career, as well as the different training pathways available to you. Just go to www.psychotherapy.org.uk/psychotherapy-training. Do you have any feedback you'd like to share with us on this episode or any from our series? Get in touch with us at communications@ukcp.org.uk.